Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. And speaking of difficult times, we're going to talk today to William David Cohen, who is author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. He spent the last 17 years working on Wall Street. And on Sunday, he and Sandy Lewis wrote a really fascinating op-ed piece called The Economy is Still at the Brink. It was fascinating in its content, but also in its graphic layout, I might say. And Bill Cohen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Mark.
This is the first time I think I've seen that in a while, this graphic layout that you had, putting in bold some of the more important thoughts that you then discussed in greater detail in your piece. I like that.
Well, we have to give credit to the New York Times editorial page for that. That was entirely their decision, but it was quite striking. And one couldn't go by that page without stopping and at least looking at what was going on there.
It was amazing. And I also was kind of amazed that the two of you, Sandy Lewis, who I've been in email conversations with and look forward to speaking to as well at some point, have obviously been in conversations with the New York Times about this article and this idea, but
yes.
the idea that two veteran men from Wall Street take a position saying, wait a minute, we're giving too much away to Wall Street, we need to step back and really rethink what we're doing.
Well, yes, I mean, I think we were uniquely a position to do that. First, from my own perspective, I worked on Wall Street from just before the crash of 1987 till January of 2004, and since then I've written two books about Wall Street, one called The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frères, about Lazard, the investment bank, and the other called House of Cards, which came out March 10th, about the collapse of Bear Stearns and what that foretold for the rest of the financial meltdown that we've experienced. And I had already been, sort of 5 years in to taking a critical look at Wall Street and the way Wall Street operates. That was not a new way of thinking for me at all. In fact, I often was critical of the way a Wall Street operated, the Wall Street social compact and its mores during the time that I was even on Wall Street, which probably maybe made me a perfect person to no longer be on Wall Street. Sandy, is a remarkable guy in that, number one, he's the first son of Cy Lewis, who was the longtime senior partner at Bear Stearns during end of the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and really brought that firm from a small firm to an important firm on Wall Street. And I first met Sandy because I wanted to interview him to learn about his father, and because his father died in 1978, and so the chance to sort of get an oral history from Sandy about his father. Now, of course, I was already aware of Sandy by then because he was a legendary arbitrageur on Wall Street during the 80s, incredibly outspoken. But he had been out of the business, for about 10 plus years, and had been thinking about the business as well. And the Times piece points out, the circumstances under which Sandy left the business,
mm-hmm.
For which he has been fully pardoned and cleared by all branches of government and legal authorities. And the two of us had met. I found him fascinating, as you have, and incredibly insightful. And he had met with the Times editorial board 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I think they were equally amazed by what he had to say. And then they thought, well, maybe Bill Cohen, and I had written three pieces for the op-ed page in the previous 4 or 5 months, maybe the two of us could get together and write up what I guess has become a bit of a manifesto for the way to think about, improving the architecture of Wall Street.
Now, let's talk about this manifesto, about improving this architecture. I think that, and also I read Sandy's piece that he wrote for Bloomberg back late last year, which was fascinating in its own right, calling for
public value funds.
Yes.
Right.
And I want to kind of weave that in here a bit as you talk about your ideas. But when you write that the capital market system that is this dependent on public confidence is in trouble, I mean, that starts from a different point of view altogether than either administration seems to have taken in looking at what is wrong with Wall Street. And when you go on to say in your first major idea that this is not over by a long shot and that our banking system may need to be completely and absolutely overhauled and redesigned.
I mean, I don't think that that is a particularly controversial statement if one, is willing to think back all of 6 months ago. I mean, last September and October, when it looked like, the world was sort of ending for capitalism and nobody knew where things were heading, I don't think anybody would have said that our system was working properly and the architecture of Wall Street had served us well. And in fact, as I pointed out in my book, that architecture, that ethos, that mores, that culture, the way Wall Street funded itself, the way Wall Street bankers and traders were compensated, what they were incented to do, all was, horrific and terribly, terribly misguided. And, I think got us into this mess. So I don't think it was all that controversial 6 months ago to talk about redesigning it. What I think is shocking is that 6 months later, because as we say in this piece, I wrote that the government has got us on a morphine drip to try to, anesthetize our feelings about all of this. But with all these trillions of dollars that have now been pumped into the system, we're failing. There seems to be a loss of political will to try to address the serious problems that got us into this mess. And that, to me, is the shocking thing. Not that we would talk about trying to go back to the very foundations and rebuild a new architecture here.
Later on in the piece, and I'm kind of trying to weave this together here for our listeners, you talk about not having the foxes guarding the hen house, which is what many people argue that President Obama has done now. But you do argue that people who come out of Wall Street and people who have been in our finance system should be the ones redesigning this. I mean, that could amount to kind of a confusing, almost contradictory statement to some people.
Well, let me try to clarify it exactly. So I think what Obama has done is he has surrounded himself with academicians, theoricians, Larry Summers, an economist, a former Secretary of the Treasury, a real academic / government insider, Tim Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, IMF official, head of the New York Fed. Again, a government insider, but neither of these two key economic advisors that Obama has around him, and certainly not Obama himself, he doesn't have this background, has really worked as a trader, has worked at understanding bringing buying and sellers together around a value of a security that can be bought and sold without artificial stimulus. And all we're really saying is, instead of artificially creating markets, which is what Geithner and Summers have done, in effect, by this huge stimulus that in addition to the 787 stimulus program, there's been trillions spent propping up the asset securitization market or trying to get these assets, toxic assets, off the balance sheets of these banks, or buying every mortgage that Fannie and Freddie now produces to try to keep mortgage rates low. Instead of, what I refer to as allowing us to have a morphine drip in our arm to make us feel better, let's actually design a program you know, the traitor's design, and this was part of Sandy's idea in the piece that he wrote for Bloomberg last October, was let's create a system by which buyers and sellers will meet each other again in the market. This is a sign of a healthy market, when buyers and sellers, you know, of their own free will, meet around the value and the price of a security, and one's willing to sell and the other is willing to buy, free of third-party stimulus, free of third-party manipulation, if you will. And until that happens, we're not going to recreate, we're not going to reestablish a functioning, healthy capital market system. It's just not possible. And the sooner we take the morphine drip out of our arm and face reality, it's no different than any addiction that we have as people, any bad habit. Until we face the bad habit as adults, as mature people, you know, we're never going to get better. I think the same principle applies. Again, I don't think it's particularly controversial. What's more controversial is that, you know, the Obama administration, continuing along the lines of what the Bush administration had done, feels that, you know, some sort of artificial feel-good program is the better way to go. I just don't agree.
Well, let's kind of parse through some of the ideas that are very important that you're talking about. We're talking with William David Cohen. Bill Cohen is co-author of the Sunday op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Economy is Still on the Brink, that he wrote with Sandy Lewis. And you can connect to either by going to New York Times or please connect to by going to steinershow.org and see what we're talking about. We'll continue this conversation about this article with some other people, maybe as well with Bill Cohen later, and clearly with his co-author Sandy Lewis at a later time as well. But what you're calling for here, I mean, when you talk about that confidence will only return when the bottom of the marketplace, the people who make their mortgage payments, who work the jobs that pay for things in America, only then will confidence return. When confidence returns from the bottom up, it's almost, this is the same thing that people who might identify themselves as progressive Democrats are saying, that we're starting at the wrong place and that transparency has to happen and only the government can do that. So talk a bit about how you and Sandy envision what this article turns into in terms of what we should be doing.
Well, first, it's not meant to be, you know, political.
I didn't mean that. Right.
I mean, it's just a basic fact of life, right? If I'm worried I'm going to lose my job, or if I've got my job, but, you know, it doesn't pay me, you know, I can barely afford my mortgage payments, or I'm in danger of losing my house. I mean, like, you know, Edmund Andrews wrote, you know, in the New York Times Magazine. I mean, here's a guy who covers economics for the New York Times and writes a book about how he is about to lose his home. So, I mean, you know, until people feel better about their careers, about their job path, about being able to pay for their mortgage, who's going to spend any money buying a car or going to Disneyland or anything else that isn't, you know, absolutely essential? I mean, you know, we learn in business schools about Maslow's needs hierarchy. You know, until basic needs are met, we don't, as a species, as human beings, we don't have any desire to, you know, until we can eat and clothe our family and put a roof over our heads. I mean, forget all the things that we used to spend money on. I mean, and the irony here is that for the first time in a generation, Americans are actually being more frugal. They're spending less. Now, that's not going to help you stimulate the economy. On the other hand, the government is keeping interest rates artificially low, which is, you know, badly causing people who save additional pain. Instead of getting more of a market rate return on their savings, they're getting, you know, infinitesimal return on their savings. You can barely see it in your bank statement. It's
right.
So low.
That's right.
And so we're not. We need to be rewarding savers. We need to be rewarding people who are being frugal, and we need to restore the confidence at that level of the of society, rather than spending all these trillions trying to boost up the top pinnacle of the pyramid, you know, the banks, the insurance companies, the hedge funds, the private equity funds. These people are not suffering. Even if they lose their jobs, they're not suffering. They've made so much money in this gluttonous stew we've been involved in for the last 25 years, they're not the ones who are suffering. It's the people, you know, in the Inner Harbor of Baltimore, who I spent time, visiting with when I wrote my book House of Cards, and the people who can't make their mortgage payments, people who worry about putting food on the table. I mean, where's that focus on that group of people?
Well, it doesn't seem to be there at this moment. So,
I'm sure to some degree it is. I mean, there was talk about resetting mortgage payments in mortgage contracts, and but I'm not really seeing the same enthusiasm either in the executive branch or in Congress for working on that part of the problem. We are in a deflationary environment, and deflation is very, very painful. You know, as assets lose value left and right, that's not going to do anybody any good.
So when the two of you call for total transparency, that there should be a truth commission to get to the bottom of how this world of securities and derivatives got us into this disaster, so we can fully understand it. I mean, most people don't understand in our culture. They hear the words derivative, asset-backed securities, credit default swaps. People's eyes and ears glaze over because what the hell does it mean? Talk about the power for you, too, of transparency in all this and how that works.
Well, I mean, there are several aspects of what we're thinking, but, I mean, to me, one of the, there is an incredibly unique opportunity here to get to the bottom of what happened here and why. When the market crashed in 1987, when the stock market went down 22.6% in one day, and we managed to make it through that, there was the Brady Commission was formed, headed up by the former Secretary of the Treasury, Nicholas Brady, and there was an investigation of market mechanisms and what went wrong and why, and, an inch and a half thick report was produced, and, theoretically, we had a public disclosure, we had some public bloodletting, we knew what happened and why, and we, sort of vowed never to have that happen again. Of course, we did repeat a lot of those things, but at least there was a public airing. At the moment, there's been nothing. There's been, my book, there's been a couple of other books,
right,
and there are more on the way, but it's Congress who has the power to subpoena. It's prosecutors who have the power to subpoena. I mean, it's even some of the documents that were given to Congress as part of the hearings that were held in last April of 2008 in the case of Bear Stearns, in October of 2008 in the case of Lehman Brothers, documents, boxes of documents were produced, and yet they're not sharing them with us. And not one CEO has come forward out of any of these Wall Street firms to explain to the American people what happened at their firms and why, how we got into this mess and why, and what their role was in creating it. And I just think there's a huge opportunity for education and to learn, and we're letting it slip through our fingers. Sandy and I proposed that part of the quid pro quo for being able to pay back the TARP money, which seems now to have happened, to be able to, they got the green light today, was to have the CEOs of these firms, before they're able to pay it back, to sit for a public deposition in front of the American people, get asked a series of questions, and explain what happened here and why, so we can learn, so we can prevent it from happening again, instead of, rushing back as quickly as we can to reestablish the status quo.
Well, let me ask you a quick question before it's time to move on, and I really do hope that we can talk to St. Louis soon and even have you back for a longer discussion. I just think this is really important, what the two of you are trying to get to for the rest of us in many ways. But I want to ask you the why. Why do you think it's happening this way? What are the forces that do not allow this transparency to take place at this moment? What do you think that is?
I wonder about that myself. I don't understand why we still don't know why they decided to save AIG and let Lehman Brothers fail why? I mean, you know, there are conspiracy theories that abound.
Right.
There are ideas that Wall Street, the nexus between Wall Street and government has always, it's either been a revolving door. The ties, the monetary ties, are very deep and long ranging, and you know, Wall Street, you know, funds the war chest of many a congressman or senator, and you know, that's nothing new. And you know, maybe it's because the powerful lobbies and all those cynical reasons that you can come up with. You know, when you see this mad dash to reestablish the status quo, when 6 months ago we all agreed that it needed to be changed, you know, these conspiracy theories and these cynical views sort of rise to the top like cream to the top of milk, and it just, instead of using this opportunity to make serious and needed changes, the old horrors are sort of coming back to play here. And I personally was hoping that President Obama was, you know, would take a different approach to all of this.
And I also wonder then if what you and the people you talk with and how you think through the idea of them, what should happen if AIG, if certain large banks are allowed to fail, if money is placed in other places to shore up the economy, as opposed to bailing out some of the Wall Street firms and large banks, what then is the prescription that you consider?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, as the Austrian economist Joseph Schumpeter spoke about, you know, this idea of creative destruction in capitalism, it's a necessary part. Jefferson talked about how, you know, every 25 years we need to, you know, sort of go through a mini revolution. You know, I think that is the healthy way. You know, nothing is forever. Nothing is certain except for death and taxes. And, you know, the way of the world is that, you know, if you make the right decisions, the prudent decisions, you get rewarded and you prosper. If you make the wrong decisions, you know, you should go out of business as a company. And you know what? The demand for the services that were once provided by the Bear Stearns and the Lehman Brothers and the Merrill Lynch's of the world, the demand is still there. The demand for capital around the world is still there. Other companies will rise up out of the ashes, the green shoots, if you will. The green shoots belong to the new entrepreneurs and the new companies that rise to the fore in this situation to take advantage of the foibles of others. And that's just the healthiest way to go about recreating and reestablishing a healthier system than trying to prop up the old verities. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me, but yet that's what we're doing.
And finally, is there a role then for the public in your perspective? I mean, when Sandy Lewis writes about the Public Value Fund, almost like a publicly owned trading house, the Peace Corps of the bond market, as he wrote, others have argued that we need to have a U.S. bank, like there's the Bank of North Dakota, that we need to have greater oversight and regulation over this question of securities trading and derivatives. I mean, what role do those kinds of things play in all this for the two of you?
I mean, a huge role. I mean, like it or not, we are, the American people are now the de facto partners with money center banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, anybody who can now back up to the Fed and get money. Any firm that we have these investments into, Citigroup and Bank of America and all these firms, I mean, we are the partners. We have become, they forced us into partnership. We didn't ask to be their partners. The people who ran these four firms, the mistakes that they made, they forced upon us the role as being their partners. We didn't ask for it. We don't want it. We shouldn't have given it to them. We should have said no. And I think things would have been fine, okay? It would have been traumatic, yes. Jobs would have been lost, yes. Investors and creditors would have lost money, but I think, and all that is traumatic, yes. But we went through a pretty big trauma, and we're kind of out the other side at the moment, and the question is, have we anesthetized ourselves by not making the changes that needed to be made? Have we failed to seize upon this opportunity? And yes, there'll be new regulation, but again, it's already morphing. It's already changing. They were talking about making an all-powerful regulator. Now they're, you know, talking about keeping it the same as it has been. I mean, I just don't see what was so great about the status quo that they're so busy, you know, returning to it as quickly as possible.
William David Cohen, co-author with Sandy Lewis, the really fascinating op-ed in Sunday Opinion section of the New York Times on June the 7th called The Economy is Still at the Brink. He's the author of House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street. Spent many years on Wall Street, is now a contributing editor as well at Fortune magazine. And Bill Cohen, thank you so much. I hope that you'll join us again.
It'd be my pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Hugh Pocock, a fascinating artist and environmental activist about his work. Stay with us for that and don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Hugh Pocock, who's a fascinating art and professor at MICA, artist and professor at MICA, environmental activist, and we'll hear more about his work in a moment. I'll remind you first that the Urbanite radio stories here on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible in by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts. Located in Baltimore at www.baltimoremediation.com. And in the studio with us is Hugh Pocock, who is an internationally exhibited artist, whose current show is My Food, My Poop at Contemporary Museum in Baltimore. He's a professor at MICA, where he teaches sculpture, video, and social practice courses, and one course called Sustainability, Art, Design, and Social Practice. And Hugh, good to see you again. Welcome to the studio.
Oh, it's good to see you, Mark.
So I love the title of the new exhibit at the Contemporary, My Food, My Poop, but it is, which is the way we have to describe things on the air. Especially,
it's just worth hearing you say the word. It really is.
But this idea, let's talk about what motivated you to do this exhibit and this concept of how sustainability fits into this, and because it really is about who we are, isn't it? My Food, My Poop.
Well, it's the title's a little misleading because what I'm interested in most is that space in between my food and my poop, which is energy. And with the global conversation about energy, as an artist, I'm really interested in investigating what energy actually is and going further into trying to sort of understand some of its materiality and how it moves through both food systems and human systems. So what I did with the project was to try to set up a structure for myself to some ways calibrate what I needed as, in terms of energy to run my daily life, and then to try to track what happened to that energy.
Now, but you literally, in part of the process, what I've seen from the exhibit is, I mean, you kept notebooks, details, what you ate, how much it weighed, literally. What you pooped and peed out, how much that weighed, literally. And talk about how that fit into your design, why you did that and how that fits into how you just discover what energy you used.
Right. Well, I've always been interested to know what the difference is between how much I ate and how much waste product I created. And with this, I decided to take the time, and after Irene Hoffman at the museum talked to me.
At
the Contemporary Museum. I proposed the project to her, and she said that she wanted to go for it. So I was like, okay, I'll start trying to figure out how to measure this. So I started weighing all intakes and all outputs, and then do the simple subtractive math. So I subtracted the waste measurements from the input food and drink measurements, and in that equation there left me with another weight measurement of the missing energy, the missing weight. So while it's not an exact science, the measurement was really pretty large. I was surprised. At first I thought that the difference between input and output might be a matter of grams.
Uh-huh.
Actually turns
might
out
be relatively equal.
Yeah, they'd be relatively equal.
Right.
I would eat food, there'd be a period of time, and then I would have outputs, and they would basically be the same. But it turned out to be really a matter of pounds. And So this kind of made me start to really sort of see this was a significant, that my body was turning a significant amount of the food that I ate into energy. There was certainly there's sort of respiration and sweat and tears and so forth, you know, where there's other excretions, but
different fluids come out in different ways, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I always tell people I'll tell them as much as they want to know.
And so, I don't know about all your fluid aspects, but I understand. There's a number of ways to get it out there.
Yeah, yeah. There's sort of, but, you know, we all do the same thing, so we can all imagine.
Anyway,
yeah. So, but it turns out that our bodies and my body convert pounds of food into something that then ends up being kind of missing in our waste product. And this, and so my project was to sort of try to see if I could follow that energy through the interactions that I have with other people, the things that I do, the conversations I have, and then started becoming really aware that, say, the sound of my voice right now is propelled by the energy and the food that I ate this afternoon. Not only, you know, our body functions of heart pumping and respiration are propelled by the caloric energy in the food, which is, you know, solar energy turned into grasses, turned into different food products, but also our interactions we have with other people, you know, in talking and our thoughts and things like that, that those get transferred in terms of energy as well.
So what did you learn from this? I mean, I'm curious about two things, about what you learned out of this, and I'm going to talk about this is art and you as an artist doing this, but I mean, what literally came out, and I don't know if you make a pun out of this, but...
Yeah, well, they're endless. There's lots of
endless puns we could do. All day we could do these puns.
Yeah, yeah. But, I always say it came as a relief to me to be over.
But I mean, what did you really learn from this? What came out of this for you when you finished this project?
Well...
There I go again. But anyway, I digress.
Well, one is as an artist, I get to have the opportunity to really investigate the deeper meaning of things. And also as a performative artist and the type of work I'm interested in, I get to personally then have a deeper connection to things that I'm interested in. In the past, they've been other materials such as water and soil and salt and time. And with this project, the issue of energy, I found really to be one that we're globally engaged with as a culture and a society. And it tends to be sort of relegated down to our interaction with fossil fuels and our culture's relationship to that energy, and then the repercussions of that. But on top of that is our larger relationship with this kind of much greater force of energy as a whole, which tends to come from the sun. And as an artist, I wanted to be more engaged in that. So in some ways, to have a deeper understanding and of an appreciation of what that relationship is, that I owe everything I do to the energy that's embodied in the food that I eat. And that has some relationships with fossil fuels and its transportation and its processing,
right.
But also a great deal of its dependency and interconnectedness with the solar food cycle.
I mean, because when you talk about that, and I'm looking at one of your notebooks, and you know, you consumed during this final day, I guess. Day 63 is the last day? Is that
yeah.
And you consumed a mango, coffee, bread, water, coffee, figs, a sandwich, didn't say what kind, chips, and an apple, and talked about their total weight. And you also talked about when you peed and pooped during the course of the day. But did it give you two questions? I mean, as an artist, is somebody kind of looking to find a way to understand sustainability in your own world with this? Mm-hmm. What did it show you?
Well, one, it really made me see some of the difference between fossil fuels and the energy that's in food and how interdependent they are. And in a fossil fuel challenged future that we're heading into, that's something to really, really be aware of. And it also made me understand that we are intimately in a web work of energy transfer, you know, biologically and geologically, and that we're part of this. And how we interact with it is vitally dependent to our own lives and to the life of further biology, you know, around us.
Right.
So what I wanted to do in the project was to sort of really sort of clearly and plainly sort of reveal that our food and our waste are part of this larger system. And that, you know, it was nice to sort of get a little bit more intimate with waste products because we tend to be in a culture of shame around waste and we have a really real big inability to actually cope with them. But they are part of a larger sort of nutrient and energy transfer that we're really not looking after.
So, and I mean, literally, I mean, this must have been an awkward project.
Yeah. It was.
To have to weigh everything that you.
Yeah. At times it got a little annoying and a little.
I would imagine.
Bizarre as well. You know, there were some pretty interesting moments in there. But I had to. and it was also like. It was hard not to cheat, you know, and it was also like trying to figure out why would I cheat? You know, I set it all up for myself. So,
right. Just cheating on yourself.
Yeah. You know, peeing in a jar in a public restroom is kind of an awkward situation.
Walking out with it actually would be the most difficult thing to try to do. Bring it back to the table.
Weighing it on a scale on the floor, you know, is like very, you know, but at the same time, it's nice to sort of, I like being in situations when normal behavior gets disrupted. You know,
I'm
trained as an artist. So, and actually rupturing that normal behavior is actually usually when good information comes out. I like doing that. And also with the food, it made me really appreciate the food. Sure, because by the time I got it, I really wanted to eat it.
Right. yeah, on both ends, I see how that would be.
Yeah,
true. We get through both these things. We talk about this as a work of art. I mean, I can hear people asking the question, what does this have to do with art?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of art is that we always get to ask that question. And hopefully that question always propels the field of art forward. I don't, you know, whether art's ever defined or not, I'm engaged in the profession of, you know, teaching it. And one of the things I do as an educator is, you know, really impress upon students that art's never definable, that they're actually the people that are going to define it next.
Right.
So, and as a work of art, it hopefully art conveys information in a manner so that the information can be absorbed in a way that is really expansive and broadens an understanding of maybe something that's simple. People have been painting trees and horses for a really long time, and a good one will, like, expand people's appreciation of a tree or a horse.
Right.
And the field of art that I'm in, and there's certainly multiple fields of art, I don't believe in one, is that hopefully some of this information about our daily lives and our interaction with the world around us and the gets conveyed in a manner that improves other people's understanding of who we are.
Talk to me for just a minute as we kind of move into some more of the work you do and what you're teaching and how this all fits in. When you say your field of art,
mm-hmm.
Talk about your field of art. What is your field of art?
It's probably like one of the lesser paid fields of art.
But it's not painting portraits for the wealthy is what you're saying.
But I'd also like to think that the lesser paid fields are always the most interesting and hopefully the most in the long term challenging. I come from I studied art when I was an undergraduate, I was in San Francisco, and I studied from early West Coast conceptualists of Howard Fried and Terry Fox and Paul Koss. And those people were inheritors of the sort of the late 60s, 70s opening up of art to be about ideas more than images, and sort of related to conceptualism. This has changed. I don't want to go into a whole history,
no, that's okay.
art history lesson. But, you know, one of the reasons I've remained an artist is that at this point I have, it's that approach has given me a lot of freedom that I kind of get to do a lot of what I want. And that I get to, it's a type of academic studies, academic and scientific study of ideas, but on a much more abstract level, where I get to be engaged in very broad ideas as an artist. And usually these ideas necessitate a kind of change in what I'm doing and how I'm operating in my daily life. Or they necessitate a kind of a focus, a work focus, where I have to learn how to do something. So then that process of learning, it becomes part of the work. I did an investigation of water at one point, and I learned how to drill a well. And through learning how to drill a well, I learned about geology and hydrology and history and the history of water use and well drilling and all these other fields, but just through one process of learning how to drill a well for water.
We're talking with Hugh Pocock. His latest exhibit is at the Contemporary Museum in Baltimore called My Food, My Poop. He's a professor at MICA. He teaches sculpture, video, and social practice classes. It's part of our sustainability conversations we're having on there that are funded by the Tom Creek Foundation. And Hugh, what we haven't really touched on, we did a little bit, was you're mixing, and as many other people are doing at MICA, some people I've met, of art and kind of social activism, for want of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you seem to be in the middle of that, whether it's the urban agricultural movement that you're part of and you're mm-hmm. teaching, or this course that you teach on sustainability in art.
Mm-hmm.
And this mm-hmm. exhibit you're doing fits into all that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mike is interesting to me in that the whole Master of Community Arts program that they have, the whole idea that
yeah, a good program.
Artists that are engaged in the mm-hmm. social, cultural, and political life, if you will, of the place that we live.
Yeah. Well, to go out into my own maybe professional opinion, is that the role of artist is rapidly changing and will change further in the next few decades, I believe. In Baltimore, we live in a slow boil crisis of social implosion, and due to race and class and globalization, and I think many young people are becoming aware of some of these dire predictions that are coming about of climate impact on the next, you know, their lifetime, and maybe two or three more generations down, and so. What I'm interested in as a teacher is to develop courses that prepare students for that world, and that world being a world that's impacted by both the direct impacts of climate change and the ecological impacts of climate change and the urban impacts of climate change, and also the professional impacts on their different fields. Most fields, from design to printmaking to photography and sculpture, being really very heavily influenced by the discourse on sustainability and a destabilized climate. The courses that main course you mentioned I'm teaching is about preparing students with the information of climate change and the field of sustainability, and helping them prepare to be well equipped for that, and also then to be the shapers of what happens to it, that they're getting up. Art students and design students are producers of culture. They either instigate it or they further it. And students and artists now, I do think that there is a greater desire to be socially engaged, and that some of the liberty that we have had in the past to create objects and images to reflect upon, there's a bit more now of urgency to make work that is actually engaged in culture.
So in this course you have, this course in sustainability that you're teaching, mm-hmm. let me talk about that in that context. I mean, you're teaching students. I saw some of the work on the web.
Hmm.
I'd love to see it in real life. I've seen this the work on the web. Then the students, like one student went out and literally collected trash from behind his or her house.
Mm-hmm.
Everything from plastic bottles to used condoms, and created a work out of that about our lives. And someone else right. talked about somebody dropping tea bags from a fifth floor of a building, and how they how that splat said something to him, and had to create some art out of.
Right.
So talk
well,
about.
Well, one is it's a pleasure to deal with, to work with these students that are explosively creative. How they my method of teaching is I like to deliver the information and have them respond to the information according to their interests, because I think that artists need to be given free rein to grow. A number of students, and they're a broad range from the applied arts of design and illustration. Mm-hmm. To the fine arts of painting and sculpture. But what hangs it together is this common dialogue about sustainability and impacts of climate change. And we read the IPCC report, and they get it's called the bad news, good news class, where the bad news is what the predictive science looks like, and then the good news is how much people are engaged in doing something about it. So I've had students do a wide array of
yeah.
things. And there's some students that are working on a sort of a very practical manner. I have one student that's actually conducting a greenhouse gas survey for MICA right now to try to figure out how much greenhouse gas the school produces. I had a student who was interested in creating Twitter sites that would be linked to smart meters in their homes, so people would then start being competitive about how much energy they were saving at home. It'd be like a real-time energy saving competition. And then I have students that do more sort of idea-based, practical. I had a student who took all the discarded refuse from her apartment, where, you know, most apartment buildings have a room in the basement filled with the stuff people don't want,
right.
from
right.
you know, exercise equipment,
right.
to pairs of shoes, to old paintings, to that room. So she took that room and made it look nice, and rearranged everything and displayed things, and invited everyone to come back down and take each other's stuff home. And she turned it into like the basement department store, a free store in the basement. So she rearranged this space that was in the basement of most apartment buildings, which is like this kind of discarded place, into a free store and art gallery, which was like this, which is a nice sort of expression that what we think of as waste is so valuable, and that what we need to do now is start, you know, recovering all the lost energy in our waste.
So I wonder if we can just conclude a bit with your thoughts about the role that artists play and the role that artists will play in our consciousness and in our battle for a sustainable world.
Well, I'd like to, you know, I think that, it's between us and the scientists. You know, the scientists, you know, to save
the
world.
It's a good balance, I think.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I'd like to say that artists can imagine. Right now, scientists are predicting a future, and artists can imagine it, and also they can imagine solutions that practical culture can actually. Don't think is possible. But artists can start imagining, and they can also demonstrate and they can we have the luxury to sort of depict ways to get from point A to point D. Scientists help us think about A to B, but artists help us between A to D. And right now, we really need to think about A to D a lot. And Baltimore, you know, is a really dynamic place for artists to be because the social and urban issues of Baltimore are so both dire, but they're also the ones that if we can fix these problems, you know, then we've made some huge effort. You know, we've fixed some really big global problems, the ones that exist in Baltimore. And if artists are engaged in that, then they're engaged in, like, some of the key issues.
Hugh Pocock, this has been phenomenal. I want to thank you so much for the work you do for coming in the studio today, work you do with your students.
Thank you, Mark. I've always been a great admirer of your show.
And Hugh Pocock's work is now at the Contemporary Museum in Baltimore, My Food, My Poop. You can go to his website, which is...
HughPocock.net.
And you can see more of his work. It's all connected on our website, so you can just go there and see it. Again, Hugh Pocock, been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, and Jackson Hubolt. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MICU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.